You're listening to NewYorkTalkRadio.net.
Stay tuned for Steal This Radio with Mitchell Cohen.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Welcome back to Steal This Radio. This is Mitchell Cohen here in New York City. Last week we talked about the goat that was arrested in Nigeria and being held in prison for armed robbery. This week we talk about the groundhog. And here we have a mayor, Michael Bloomberg, who's a billionaire digging up the city's parks. They call it development, to suit the tastes of corporate universities like NYU or Columbia and the upper-class folks who live near them. Well, my friend Sandy Griffin, who joins us on this show, is from out of town and staying in an apartment near Gramercy Park, which is a publicly owned park, but it's rarely open to the public, even though our taxes pay for its upkeep, and you need a key to get into the park. But don't get me started. Well, February 2nd was Groundhog Day, and the mayor was out in Staten Island harassing and bullying Chuck, the 10-pound, 3-year-old groundhog. So the lovely, gentle creature, who had never been in trouble before, did the only thing he could. He chomped on Bloomberg's hand, piercing the glove and requiring some minor medical assistance to the mayor. The story was reported in the New York Times on the blog, and scores of commentators lashed out at Mayor Bloomberg. One commentator wrote, "Bloomberg deserved to be bit. If you look at the video, he keeps taking Chuck's food away, reaching into his house after him when he runs away, pushing Chuck on the head and finally grabbing him to hold him up for a photo while Chuck is scrambling for dear life, having no idea what's going on. The video shows that Bloomberg is, perhaps unintentionally, but nonetheless brutishly tormenting Chuck." Another sarcastic person wrote, "Send Chuck to Gitmo." And another wrote from the New York Times blog, "I was not amused by Bloomberg's photo op antics with the poor woodchuck. Any child, even a billionaire or a Bush, should know not to tease a wild animal. Bloomberg was teasing Chuck, and he deserved to be bit." And then there's more. "Bloomberg's miserable attempt at humor about the incident only shows how completely he doesn't get it. He should be sentenced to a lengthy session with Big Bird, where he can learn about why teasing isn't nice." And more. NPR reported that the mayor actually picked Chuck up by the scruff of the neck. No wonder his honor got chomped. Who's the terrorist in this story? Another one wrote, "Good for Chuck. The way Bloomberg kept grabbing at him, I don't blame Chuck for biting him. Chuck and his keeper should watch out, though. Bloomberg may decide that in addition to laying off 15,000 teachers, he should also close the zoos and lay off the zookeepers and working groundhogs. After all, anything that brings any kind of joy into the life of New York City's children seems to be fair game for Bloomberg and Klein." And finally, one smartass wrote this series of headlines.
Breaking news headlines. Groundhog bites Bloomberg. Grave concerns over groundhog's condition. City's emergency command center activated. National Guard deployed. Council speaker next in mayoral succession. Police commissioner orders threat level raised to red. New Yorkers calm, even relieved.
This is a mayor who has just worked a deal with the city council to enable them and himself to violate term limits established by voters in two separate elections and run for a third time.
And we must remember that Michael Bloomberg was actually in favor of term limits when Mayor Giuliani was trying to extend his term limit into a third term because of the catastrophic events of 9/11.
Using 9/11 as an excuse for doing this.
Right. So, I mean, how hypocritical is that?
I'm thinking of working with the Greens to form a groundhog party to run against the mayor. What do you say? Goodbye. Well, last December, a story appeared in upstate New York newspapers about a seventh grade teacher's history lesson on slavery. The teacher, who is white, selected two 13-year-old black students to reenact the slave trade. She taped their hands and feet. Can't believe she taped their hands and feet and made them crawl into a space under a desk to simulate, she said, what it must have been like for slaves transported in ship's holds during the voyage to America. Anyway, one of the students was really upset. Not very hard to imagine why. The teacher said she was trying to teach her class about the horrors of slavery and that she was very, 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 very sorry if the lesson hurt anyone.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free. And that's what the teacher said to me. That's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometime. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned our government must be strong. It's always right and never wrong. Our leaders are the finest men, and we elect them again and again. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school today. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that war is not so bad. I learned about the great ones we have had. We fought in Germany and in France, and someday I might get my chance. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
Well, I think we've all been scarred in many ways by schooling.
For me, I remember any number of experiences, many of them concerning having to ask the teacher publicly for the pass in order to go to the bathroom. Yeah, remember those days when you needed a pass to piss? Anyway, I was thinking of all this while reading Derek Jensen's great book, Walking on Water, Reading, Writing, and Revolution. It took me a long time to read this very accessible book because it kept triggering memories from my own life, and I'd keep putting it down, jotting some notes, picking it back up. We often think of free public education as a good thing. The workers and the working class in this country fought and bled and died in order to be able to establish education as a right so that our children could go to school for free, just like wealthier folks. And yet being forced to sit in school hour after hour, day after day, 13 years of our lives, what does that do to us?
And we'll be right back after these announcements.
Hey, welcome back to Steal This Radio. This is Mitchell Cohen here in New York. Back in the 60s, the New Left, which I was part of, challenged all the assumptions of public education. We designed experimental schools, rejected grades, asked,
what are we really learning?
And these ideas were carried forth by all sorts of writers challenging the educational system.
Here's an interesting section about the history of mandatory public education and why the Rockefeller sector of the ruling class funded it.
Let me quote from Derek Jensen's book here.
Well, it should surprise us less than it does that the educational system destroys students' souls. From the beginning, that's been its purpose. Don't take my word on this, Derek Jensen writes. Take it from the people who set up the system. In 1888, the Senate Committee on Education, nervous about the high quality of education provided by non-standardized localized schools, where teachers actually taught students to think for themselves, reported, quote, this is from the Senate Committee,
"We believe that education is one of the principal causes of discontent of late years, manifesting itself among the laboring classes."
Even John Dewey.
"Every teacher should realize he is a social servant set apart for the maintenance of the proper social order and the securing of the right social growth."
Unquote. What are the proper social order and the right social growth? In 1906, Elwood Cubberley, who later became dean of education at Stanford, gave his answers.
"Schools should be factories in which raw products, children, are to be shaped and formed into finished products, manufactured like nails, and the specifications for manufacturing will come from government and industry."
They all thought this was a good thing, to manufacture students, to be on assembly lines, as Phil Oakes put it.
"And every single classroom is a factory of despair."
No wonder we all hate school, Derek Jensen writes, and the fact that we do hate school is a very good thing. It means we're still alive. So I thought I'd invite the author of Walking on Water, Derek Jensen, onto the show to talk about what it means to be alive and how to overcome the mental and physical shackles holding us back. Hey, is this Derek?
Yeah, it's Derek.
Yeah, hey, this is Mitchell Cohen here in New York, and I'm here with Sandy Griffin in the studio and Sean Velasquez.
Oh, hey.
So welcome, Derek Jensen, and honored to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
In reading your book, you've been a critic not only of education, but education as a symptom of the kind of civilization we live in, and you've written mostly on environmental questions, challenges, a more radical approach to civilization today than, say, The Pursuit of Loneliness by Philip Slater and other books from the 60s and early 70s. And you're taking that to a new dimension, into the dimension of ecology and the destruction of the planet, supporting radical environmental movements. So how does the educational system and the resistance to it fit in with the larger ecological questions pertaining to civilization?
I think that part of the answer for that is in those quotes that you gave about the purpose of schooling, and has to do with what is really taught in school. I've got like 13, 14 books out now, and honestly, I think that the first two lines of Walking on Water are my favorite, or close to my favorite, and they are, if I recollect, as is true for most people I know, I've always loved learning. As is also true for most people I know, I hated school. Why is that? For me, I realized in like 9th and 10th grade that it would really only take maybe 3 or 4 years to teach most of the material that you learn in school, such as in math. I mean, what do you really learn in math in the first couple grades after you learn fractions and decimals and negative numbers? What do you really learn until algebra? It's pretty much not a lot, and the same is true for the other subjects. I learned most of my reading, of course, outside of school, and I learned, frankly, most of my math from watching baseball. You know, I wanted to know how to figure out ERA, so I learned how to do...
And I was doing batting averages, so we're in the same ballpark here.
Exactly. And so I really didn't understand when I was younger why school takes so long. And I thought at the time that it was probably because they wanted to break you of the habit of daydreaming, because I would just sit in the class daydreaming all day long. And it gets really boring, you know, to win the World Series 17 times every hour for 8 hours a day. And what I finally realized is that the reason that school takes so long is it takes that long to sufficiently break the wills of children to prepare them for their lives of painful employment, to prepare them for spending the next 40 years working at jobs they probably don't love. I used to have this habit of asking people if they like their jobs. About 90% say no. And what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing stuff they don't want to do? And so my point is, to come back to your question, how does this relate to the larger question, is that for me, it really became clear that a lot of school is really about getting children to not question authority, to have to raise their hand before they go to the bathroom, like you said, to get a pass. I taught at a university, and then later on I taught also at a prison, and a maximum security prison, Supermax, here in Northern California, Pelican Bay. And in no way do I mean to demean how horrible life is for the prisoners, but at the same time I have to say that it reminded me a lot of high school, except that the hall monitors have clubs.
You don't owe me. Don't say I can't go with other boys.
My point is regimentation. And one of the things that school does is it prepares you to put up with a life of regimentation, and prepares you to put up with a life of standardization, and prepares you to put up with a life of boredom. That's my primary memory of school, is extraordinary boredom. And that's true of most of the people that I know and knew. And so the way it relates to the larger picture, once again, it really works toward helping us become a nation of slaves.
And so, tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to say. And please, when I die with you, don't force me out to say, no, you don't know.
We have also in the studio with us Sandy Griffin, who at one time in her life was a teacher in Montessori school, which is a different kind of school.
But first I'm going to just say what was coming to mind, and that was that, Derek, if you had been doodling in school instead of daydreaming, you could have, you know, turned to fine art like I did. lots of very discreet doodling. Yeah, Maria Montessori had some pretty revolutionary ideas about schooling, but in the decades that have passed, it's been really watered down, and not a lot of her ideas are out there today. It was a self-directed learning with kids, and the idea of getting information through your senses and refining your senses, starting with colors, with shapes, and moving on into more intricate learning.
I don't actually know a lot about Montessori schools. What I've heard has been pretty good. And so I went to school, and then I went to, you know, I was so stupid that I went to college. You know, it's like I say in the book that, you know, it takes 12 years to sufficiently break the wills of children, and those who are especially slow go to college. And for the exceedingly obstinate child, there's graduate school.
Where did you go? What school?
I went to the Colorado School of Mines. It's an engineering school in Colorado. And didn't like it at all, hated it. And so I went back to graduate school and lasted for 1 year there, most of a year, and then dropped out of graduate school and spent my 20s doing other things and went back to get an MFA, a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing. And the reason I bring all this up is because the words you said about self-directed are what I'm responding to here, that's the only time I ever liked school was when I got the MFA. And it wasn't really because particularly of the school itself, but it was because at that point, I was mature enough to be self-directed and to say, I want to do this and I don't want to do that. And my teachers and advisors were mature enough to say, great, and to tailor my learning process to what I wanted to learn, you know, what a concept that is. I did have one good experience at school that way. And the other is that I talked to some students a while back at a high school, this was maybe 3 or 4 months ago, at a high school, that was just great. It was very self-directed, and the kids were so smart, and the teachers were really smart, and they were asking these great questions. They were very respectful of authority at the same time that they are not bowing down to it.
We're listening to Derek Jensen here on Steal This Radio. Derek's the author of Walking on Water, Reading, Writing, and Revolution, and also a whole slew of other books about environment, about government, and so on. And we'll return right after the break.
Don't tell me what to do.
Hi, this is Mitchell Cohen on Steal This Radio in New York City, and this is John Lennon.
lot of people consider me an anarchist, and I may or may not be, and in many ways I am. And I've gotten into some disagreements with some anarchists because there are some anarchists who have basically thrown out all authority. I think that just because the authority that we are normally presented with is toxic, that doesn't mean that we should never have respect for someone who is our elder or for someone who knows more than we do. An example of that is when I lived in Spokane. I don't live there now. I used to live in Spokane, Washington. I used to go hunting. It's a terrible, terrible hunter. The joke I always used to tell is that the only thing I ever got is lost. And the friends I would go hunting with were really, really experienced and really, really good. And so as we're driving out to the place we would hunt, I never even took a shot. I mean, I would just wander around, you know, and literally get lost. So as we're driving out in the truck, we're equals. But as soon as we get out of the truck and as soon as they hand me the gun from the gun rack, I do what they tell me to do because they know much more than I do. And it'd be the same if I were riding with somebody who was 18. We can be equals when we are trying to figure out what we're going to eat, but then when it comes to writing something, I have more experience. My point is that these students at this school had proper respect for their teachers, and they also had proper disrespect for their teachers. It was great. They had a good relationship. At one point, I said, you know, I don't really understand what this school is about. Why is this so different? So tell me about this school. And it ends up it was one of those sort of last chance schools, and that's how they describe it, you know, last chance for kids at risk and basically kids who've gotten in trouble with the law and other various problems. I just started laughing, and I said, man, if I wouldn't have been such a goody-two-shoes and a wimp when I was in high school, I would have done anything. I would have, like, hey, you want me to go shoplift so I can go to the school? Because this is how a school should have been. I mean, I'm not opposed to the notion of collectivized learning. What I'm opposed to is the regimentation and the forced respect for authorities who don't respect us back.
My last year in high school, I taught over the summer for a couple of years in Spanish Harlem, and it was to young adults who were going back to school, so they were very motivated to learn English. Most of them spoke Spanish, English, and math. And it was very difficult, but also very empowering because everybody there wanted to learn. And a lot because, not just for the love of learning, but they also had jobs that depended on it. They wanted to get out of the hole that they were in economically. And after a time, I remember how the one woman there couldn't get the idea of fractions. That was the most difficult thing for most people to get. And I tried every which way to teach them fractions, the same way we learn in school, dividing up pies, doing pennies, putting half here, half there, and nothing would come across. And finally, one day, she was telling me a story about her crowded house where she lived, her apartment, and how her parents were coming to visit and her boyfriend's parents were coming to visit. So we had to put 6 in this room and 4 in the other room and 6 in this room. And I saw this. You put half in one room and then half in the other. And suddenly a light went on in her eye. Huh. And she just was amazed. And then I said, well, that's fractions. You just did it. She just understood the concept and then went around screaming to everybody in the building, I did it. I learned it. I could do fractions. And then so everybody came around because everybody was having difficulty. And instead of me trying to explain it to others, I asked her to explain to them how they did fractions.
Oh,
and
great.
She did. And so she became a teacher. And I began teaching English the same way, which was to have people who are in the class teach for the following year, to write the handbook for the next year.
Oh, so, that's a great idea.
So they become teachers. And I was stunned in your book. You had some similar concepts, but you also had a bunch of rules that I liked, your rules for writing. You had, 6 or 7 rules, and you structured the book around that somewhat. I don't know if you wanted to go through and if you remember them or if you wanted
sure.
to go through.
Let's see. The first rule of writing is don't bore the reader.
Exactly.
Because it doesn't matter how important the stuff is you have to say. If it's boring, nobody's going to read it. At every moment, you have to be giving gifts to the readers. So we would talk about what it is that keeps you tied to a movie or a book or anything else, that suspense, action, sex, jokes, learning something.
And you do all this in your class? You actually tell jokes or you talk about sex?
Oh, yeah. That was part of the deal, too, is that, I mean, the reason that it has to be such that, you know, the first rule of writing is don't bore the reader, is that any time they're picking up your book, they could be doing anything else in the world. And it's the same with somebody listening to this radio program. They could be doing anything else. They could be...
Don't bore the listeners.
Yeah. So they could be...
Sean's falling asleep in the corner.
They could be talking with a friend, they could be taking a walk, they could be having sex. And so what I always used to say to my students is that I didn't care what they wrote about, I didn't care, you know, what political positions they took. All I cared about was that their writing had to be good enough that I would rather read it than have sex. It's the same with your radio program, that, you know, it has to be interesting enough that people would rather listen in than to turn it off and have sex. Then I said it was the same with my classes. I said, look, any of you here could be staying back in your dorm room and having sex, so I have to make class more interesting than sex. That's my job, which doesn't mean I'm not taking a role. I still am, but my job is to make it as interesting as possible. So I would knock myself out to, you know, I don't think I succeeded in making it more interesting than sex. You know, let's not kid ourselves. But I did make it as interesting as possible and fun. And the way we did that, it's pretty interesting because I was just teaching freshman and sophomore composition in college. It was a required class, and I would teach a couple sections a quarter, and there might be, oh gosh, 30, 40 sections, something like that. And all the other ones would assign their students, I think, 3 papers a quarter is what they had to write. And mine would routinely write 20, 25 papers in a quarter. So a couple papers a week would not be unusual. And then they would complain when the class was over that it was too easy. And the reason they were doing all this is 2 things. One is they got to write about whatever they wanted. And the other is that I wasn't criticizing them. I would praise them. Instead of saying, awkward transition, this part stinks. You know, and I had teachers say all that stuff. You know, I'd hand in a paper and it'd be this red flood of awk, cliche, with them slashing stuff on the page. And instead of doing that, what I would do is I would say, you know, your first paragraph is really good and your third paragraph is really good. So I'm wondering if you can make a bridge between those 2 paragraphs that's just as good as those 2. By doing that, they're all excited. And I learned how to do that, really. I learned about that. You know, I mean, some from my mom, and then also from when I was in college, I was a high jumper, and my coach used to yell at the distance runners, and he was a football coach. He used to yell at the football players, but he never yelled at me, never once. And I once asked him, I said, you know, I'm glad that you don't, but why don't you ever yell at me? And he said, oh, everybody knows if you start yelling at a high jumper, they just start crying, and they can't do anything. And he's right, because had he started yelling at me, I would have quit. And he never said anything but how great I was doing. And later on, I became a high jump coach. Several years later, in my late 20s, I was a high jump coach at a junior college. And when I was jumping, I would prohibit my high jumpers from saying anything bad about anything within 100 yards of the high jump pit. I would, you know, it'd be a cold day, and I'm wearing a ski jacket, and they're wearing track outfits, and I'd say, what do you think of the weather? And if they said that the weather, they didn't like it, I'd make them run. And the reason is because in high jumping, you have to have a really positive attitude. And it paid off because the first track meet we had that had bad weather, all the other jumpers are complaining about how cold it is and how wet and slippery it is. And my jumpers are going, man, this is great because they're speed jumpers. I'm a power jumper, which means they have to go faster on the approach. So they're going to slip. I'm not going to slip. This is perfect. And they would fixate on the positive. And that doesn't mean that I wouldn't tell them how to jump better. What I would say is, like, this one jumper had terrible form. I never said your form stinks. What I'd always say is, your legs are so strong because you're popping up there and your form's not helping you. So when your form comes together with your legs, you're going to be amazing. And what he did then is he fixated on how strong his legs were. He didn't fix on how bad his form was. And you can do the same thing in writing. Just like you said about your student who understood the fractions, when I would walk into a classroom, part of what I knew is that I don't really have anything to teach them. I was at a blues concert once, years and years ago, at some little bar, and I heard this guy talking to the guitarist, his old blues guitarist. I heard him talking to the guy and saying, can you teach me how to play guitar? And the guy said, I can teach you everything I know in 15 minutes, then you have to go home and practice for 15 years. And it's the same with writing, that I just got an email from somebody a couple days ago saying, I'm 17 years old and I want to know how to write as well as you do. And I'm like, you know, what you got to do is practice. That somebody said to me when I was in my 20s, you're not a real writer until you've written a million words. And it's the same with high. Oh, here's a great high jumping story. After I was.
Hold on a sec. I have to do a break here.
Oh, that's my cue. Okay. We'll be back soon with more from Derek Jensen.
We're listening to Derek Jensen here on Steal This Radio. Derek's the author of Walking on Water, Reading, Writing, and Revolution. And we'll be right back.
The one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why.
if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh and know they love you. And you of tender years can't know the fears that your elders grew by, and so please help them with your youth. They seek the truth before they can die.
Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by. Them on your dreams, the one they fix, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh and know they.
Welcome back to Steal This Radio. We're talking with Derek Jensen about writing, and the ability to write and to be creative is really inherent in the students, trying to help bring out from the students what they already know but don't know that they know it.
Yeah, that's so right on. And the story I started to tell before the break was that after I bailed out grad school the first time, I was living in my truck for like 9 months, and it's so funny. I had two dogs and clothes and a baseball mitt and high jumping shoes, which sort of lets you know my priority as I was driving. And, you know, I had high jumping shoes because you never know. I was driving around the country. You know, I never know when I might see a high jump pit or something. And I was out in California, and I saw these guys starting to warm up outside a high jump pit. So I stopped the truck and ran over and asked if I could jump with them. And they said, sure. And I warmed up and everything. And I started doing what are run-throughs. You know, you've seen people high jump. They run up, and then they jump. And I did these run-throughs where you run up, but you don't jump. You just run through. And I did those. I did probably 50 of them. They did three or four, and then they started jumping. And then when they started high jumping, instead of running up smoothly, they'd stutter up to the bar. And on the other hand, I did like literally 50, 60, 70 run-throughs before I jumped. And then I started jumping, and they're like, oh, my gosh, when you run, your approach is so smooth. You don't stutter. And it's because every day when I would practice, I would do 50 or 60 of these. And, you know, we see these NBA players. The thing that amazes me the most about the NBA is not the dunks or anything, but it's basically almost any of them. If you leave them open, even for a three-pointer, they don't even touch rim. It just stuns me that they can hit a shot. If I could do four in a row from that distance that even made it, much less went through without touching rim, I would be delighted. My point is that they've shot thousands and thousands and thousands of shots. And it's the same with writing, that if you want to learn how to write, you've got to do it. So it wasn't that I can force feed students into learning how to write. What I can do is I can try to make the process of writing fun enough that they teach themselves. So my job was basically to cheerlead and to love them into becoming who they were.
But on the other hand, you don't take that same approach to members of the U.S. government or the executives of the corporations that are destroying the environment. You don't try to encourage them to be nice, to change their policies because they could see it from within themselves.
Through love and praise.
Through love and praise. You blast the hell out of them, and rightly so. So why the difference?
Well, I wondered about that for a while. Years ago, I was doing a talk, and some guy asked me that question. And I didn't know
that was me, probably.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, that's the thing, by the way. Also, I don't know if you know this, but most writers or most people who do Q&As, they aren't nearly as smart as they seem, because the reason they can give these smart answers is because they were asked the questions 15 times before. Because the first time I get asked a question, I'm like, huh, good question, I have no idea. And then I go home and fuss about it for a month. And anyway, so what I realized is that it all has to do with power. That if I have power over someone, as I do in a classroom, it is my responsibility to only use that power for their benefit. If, on the other hand, I see someone else who has power over someone and they're misusing that power, it is my responsibility to stop them using any means necessary. And so if I were a CEO or a politician, it would be my responsibility to use that power solely for the benefit of those who have less power than I. And if, on the other hand, I see a CEO who is misusing that power, it is my responsibility to stop him using any means necessary. That's very clear to me.
Well, I wanted to slide into the larger issues of society by way of the prison teaching that you've done, because I was very startled, and in a good way, by your discussion in your book about prisons and teaching there, and how in a lot of ways that's similar to teaching in public schools. But also there were differences that you pointed out, and the metaphors people used were different, even though some of the structure was the same. So I was wondering if you could get into that a little bit. How does teaching there differ from larger society teaching in public schools or so forth?
My friend Stephanie McMillan, with whom I did the book As the World Burns, she's a cartoonist, and As the World Burns is a graphic novel, she does a cartoon called Minimum Security. And the reason it's called Minimum Security is because there was some prisoner who got released. She said, you know, actually the truth is I'm not out of prison, I've just been moved to minimum security. His point was that the whole society at large is still a prison society, and he's absolutely right. And having said that, what was different about teaching at the prison?
And also their writings, their metaphors, okay, and so forth.
Okay. Well, the first thing about teaching there, the first thing that was different from my perspective was that, you know, like we talked about, you could be having sex instead of coming to class. I would never reference anything sexual at the prison. And the reason is because a lot of my students were lifers, so they will never again have sex. So I was not going to do anything that would remind them. And I would never say, instead of taking this class, you could be taking a walk in the forest, because they will never again walk in a forest. Many of them will never again see moonlight. So I would never say anything like that. And that was actually different. One of the worst things I thought about the prison was not simply their incarceration. And from my perspective, one of the worst things was the routine disrespect that was shown to the prisoners by the guards. And what I mean by that is they might stand right next to or stand 3 feet from a prisoner and talk really loud about what they're going to do over Christmas or the nice time they're going to have with their family over whatever holiday it is. Teachers, librarians, all that were called free staff. So I was standing next to another free staff, and she was talking to one of my students, and she happened to accidentally let slip something about Christmas in a week. Then she just stopped, and she said, I am so sorry. And she apologized to the person for reminding him accidentally that he was not going to be with his family over the holiday. And that's the sort of disrespect that they get from guards, not all guards, but most guards quite often. So the first thing is I wouldn't refer to anything that could make them feel bad that way. Also, I just want to mention, it was very interesting that after I'd been there for a few weeks, I taught there for several years, and after I'd been there for a few weeks, one of my students said, you know, you're not afraid of us. And I just looked at him and I said, why would I be afraid of you? You know, you're not going to do anything to me. They all just laugh. And that's all true. I mean, having said that, I had an alarm on my belt that I could have pushed if necessary. And also, unless I knew them very well, I didn't let them walk behind me. If somebody I didn't know was going to walk behind me, I would casually look over my shoulder.
And so you were conscious of that all the time?
Yeah, I was conscious. But I want to be very clear. I was conscious, but I was never afraid because I had no reason to be afraid. There was only one time I was ever in there that I actually got a little bit nervous. We were in areas that were generally closed off, either in a chapel or in a dedicated arts and corrections room. And we were in the chapel one day, and somebody I'd never seen before started walking by me, and I looked a little bit over my shoulder, and he kind of glared at me, and there's no guards anywhere at that point. And I said, so can I help you with something? And he started walking toward me with his fists up and said, basically, what's it to you? And I didn't even know what to say. And then this other guy who happened to be his cellmate looked up, and they hadn't seen each other before. And the guy said, look, it's cool. Settle down. And it ends up the reason that this guy was so hyperactive is because he was a member of a specific prison group that there are other prison groups have a kill-on-sight relationship with. He had reasons to be edgy, which is why he was kind of weird. But as soon as the other guy said, look, just chill, the guy chill. But that was the only time in several years that I was even the slightest bit nervous. Everything else is just, you know, it's just like teaching regular students. And so far as what they were like, they were, as I say in the book, I would say the quality of writing was on average about the same as my student at university. But the thing that was much different was the variability, that I had some who were absolutely extraordinary, extraordinary writers, and some who were functionally illiterate. One of the exercises I would do with my students at university and at prison is, one of the rules of writing is show, don't tell. I would say, how would you show that someone is angry? And my students at the university would be much less overt in what they would say. They would say, you show somebody you're angry by squinting at them really hard or by flipping them off. And the students in prison were oftentimes talking about, if I'm really angry, I'm going to pick up a chair. So I thought it was very interesting. But in general, I treated them pretty much the same, and they responded pretty much the same, that, you know, how anybody responds to praise and affection, by becoming much better writers and by having generally a good time. The other thing I want to mention about prison is that I was never politicized about drugs at all before. I've never actually thought about drugs. I've not used them. I don't even drink. You know, it's just never been a part of my life. And I hadn't really thought about them until, I would say, a good portion of my students were in there because of drugs. And I don't just mean possession, because this was a supermax. I mean like a drug deal gone bad and they killed somebody. Once again, I hadn't thought about it much, but now I'm actually quite a strong opponent of the war on drugs. Many of these people, frankly, were self-medicating. Instead of taking Valium or something, they were taking something else because they got something going on in their brain.
Or they were just trying to cope with the society.
Well, yeah, a lot of them said that. And there was one student of mine said that if he could change one image about drugs with his work, with his writing, it would be to blow away the image of drug dealers in Armani suits. And the example he gave is he was arrested for drug dealing. And he said, you try and raise a family of three in Oakland by working at McDonald's. You can't do it. And he said, dealing put food on the table. And you can't really argue with that at all. One of my students had been, he was on the streets when he was, I believe, six. I don't remember the exact age. I'm pretty sure it was six. He was living on his own. He said he still remembers his first night living in January in a cardboard box in Oklahoma City. The deprivation that so many of my students, not only is there the whole, it politicized me about drugs, didn't have to politicize me about race and class issues, because I was already politicized about those, but they're very evident too. And then the other thing is that, honestly, a lot of my students, their parents are the ones who should have been in prison, not them. Because I had students, I've written a lot about my own abuse as a child, that my father's extremely violent. He raped me, raped my mother, and raped my sister, broke my sister's arm. My brother has epilepsy from below the head. My father's extremely violent. Some of their parents made my father look like father knows best, you know? Some of my students there were put out to prostitution when they were four. No exaggeration. Others would see their parents shoot each other.
Were they able to write about this in your class, or that was not an area that you touched?
No, they could. They could write about whatever they wanted. No, that's not true. They could write about anything they wanted, except that they couldn't write about, they were disallowed officially from writing pornography. I am also a pretty big opponent of porn, but I took a fairly weak line on that, because these guys are never going to have sex again. So if they want to write a little bit about it, actually it was great, because my supervisor and I really liked my supervisor there, and he and I had a really good cop, bad cop thing going on with that, because my supervisor his job was not to supervise in classes. His was just to do the larger picture. And what I would do is, if one of my students started writing about sex, I would tell him. And it's like, that's cool, no big deal. But if they started doing it too much, like a couple, 3 weeks in a row, we would then arrange for him to show up in class, and he would then say, you know, and they wouldn't get in trouble. He would just say, you know, you're not supposed to write about that. And they would look at me, and I'd do this sort of shrug, like, you know, because when I tried to tell them not to do it, they would say, look, you're trying to make us creative, and then you're putting limits. And of course there's going to be limits. It's like, if they went too far, you know, like, if it's like, great, you can write about sex, but just don't do it every single week, you know? And so there was that limit, and also they were also prohibited from writing explicitly about killing a guard. You know, and that's they knew that, and they never even got close to that one. That was fine.
This is Derek Jensen we've been talking to. Thanks, Derek.
Okay, thanks.
Sandy Griffin here in the studio. I'm Mitchell Cohen with Sean Velasquez. Please tune in next week, where we'll be continuing this interview with Derek Jensen. See you next week on Steal This Radio in New York. Bye now.
I thought I heard the captain say, pay me my money down. Tomorrow is our sailing day. Pay me my money down. Pay me, pay me, pay me my money down. Pay me or go to jail. Pay me my money down. As soon as that